Welcome to New York, Quebec, and the water route to the center of the world. This is bonus episode 12, The Hudson Valley in Transition from 1664 to 1766, the English takeover in 1664, and the rejection by Holland several years later in the peace that followed left the Dutch merchants of the newly christened New York in an interesting position. Being under English rule allowed ways around the Navigation Acts, and only the Dutch merchants of New Netherland had the international import and export connections to meet the needs within this system. Frederick Phillips took the English oath of loyalty, and this covered his wife Margaret as well. They were granted the ability to trade directly with natives out of the newly renamed Albany, and their stocks of wampum rose almost 400% due to shortages in supply after the English takeover. The next two governors of New York profited from Phillips' shipping investments and the granting of export monopolies to Manhattan merchants that covered the entirety of the colony. A little over a decade after the English takeover, Frederick Phillips was sitting on the governor's board of advisors and was now the richest man in the colony of New York. I find it fascinating that we see major anglicizing of Dutch names by the 1660s, still with many using the original Dutch initials to mark their identity throughout life. This was an intentional aspect of the founding of the Phillips dynasty, Hardenbroek to Hardenbroek, Flyspin to Phillips, and Margaret's new child was renamed Eva Phillips, from the previously known Maria Rudolphus de Vries. Peter Stuyvesant's accords with the English allowed large migration from eastern Long Island and close to the shores of Manhattan. The English poured south from New Haven and settled the river valleys of Connecticut, as the Delaware Swedes would soon play neutral in the takeover of the English. Most folks think Peter Stuyvesant disappears from the records after 1664, but in reality he stays on and helps the new English governor through a difficult transition period. We have records of cooperation between Stuyvesant and Governor Nichols when it came to runaway slaves that were owned by the former governor general. Stuyvesant would go on to found one of the patroon landed dynasties of the Hudson Valley. His family tree would include the Bayards, Beekmans, Livingstons, and even part of the New England Winthrop family. Frederick Phillips himself had risen from carpenter to chartering ships to the tobacco fields of Virginia. He had reason to want to blend in. In 1669, a ship called the Hopewell had left from Amsterdam on the way to the tobacco fields of Virginia when it made a mystery port of call in New York. Pleading a need for relief, the captain disgorged his passengers, whom happily took with them trade goods to sell. Many of the passengers were former Dutch residents of New Netherland or current residents of the English-controlled city of New York. The ship was discovered to have two manifests of dueling nationalities and was impounded for violating the Navigation Acts. This particular vessel was owned by New York's new governor, a man by the name of Francis Lovelace. He shared ownership with a conglomerate of New York and Amsterdam merchants, so he denied all involvement and managed to get the ship out of impound. Now the Amsterdam merchants hid behind a set of shell investors who all legally resided in English New York, and the Hopewell was sailing again by the end of the year. Besides hiding outside investment, the ship made sure to stop in English territory on its way back to Amsterdam, but was allowed to trade with New York legally in the process. Trade between New York City and the Dutch Republic amounted to between 3-5 large vessels per year, a similar number to direct trade with England. From the fall of New Netherlands in 1664 through the end of the century, no less than 50 prominent Dutch-descended New York traders followed this quasi-legal pattern and gained local power many other recently conquered colonial subjects would not achieve. The involvement of Lovelace in the Hopewell also highlights what would become an enduring feature of New York's political economy: the ability of colonists to bring their governors into their trade so as to insulate themselves from prosecution, to earn special privileges, and to shape local law to suit their needs. According to historian Christian Coote, the Dutch Reformed Church, as an official appendage of the local government and responsible for education, faced a double-edged sword of toleration. This diluted Dutch loyalty along the Connecticut River and eastern Long Island. The Flushing Remonstrance in 1657 was also a clear demonstration of the Quaker presence creeping in. The porous boundaries of the colony served as buffer zones and were populated by various splinter religious groups. These ultimately turned against Dutch rule by 1664. The Glorious Revolution of 1688 expanded freedom of worship in New York, balancing against the temporary Dutch reclamation of 1673. The Dutch practiced favoritism, while the English favored plurality in matters of religion. Early New York English governors intervened for the Dutch Reformed Church, but it was no longer state-funded. The Dutch contribution to future U.S. pluralism was due to favorable timing and circumstances, keeping the Middle Atlantic colonies above English influence until they were turned over during the Royal Restoration, according to historian Jap Jacobs. The transition from one type of Protestant rule to another also played a mediating role in emerging pluralism. The Dutch Reformed Church made progress with missionary work among the Iroquois, developing an alphabet based on the Mohawk dialect. This helped in translating the common prayer book and conducting services. Dutch ministers operated within their own communities and maintained a respectful presence in both worlds, countering Jesuit behavior in the Western Seneca lands. The educational standards of the Dutch left their mark on the colony of New Netherlands and its successor state of New York. The Dutch Reformed Church and local municipalities partnered to offer the education for 6-year terms on average. The wealthy and business elite would continue education after 12 in both language and math. The first paid instructor arrived in 1624, and Peter Stuyvesant even provided educational instruction to the children of WIC Company slaves. At the tail end of New Netherlands' existence, 66% of men and 49% of women in Albany could sign legal documents with their name 50 years later, and that number had risen to 86% for men and 50% for women in English New York. Large schools existed in Albany by the 1740s. Several hundred mostly Dutch-descended boys and girls attended lessons. New York City's first English mayor, Thomas Willett, spoke Dutch fluently from his time in Holland as an exiled Puritan. He settled in Rhode Island and had started up a profitable trade partnership with New Netherland merchants. The Dutch language persisted as the lingua franca throughout most of the Hudson Valley. After the transition, Colin Calloway writes in his book, Albany was actually two towns in one, a Dutch community who maintained their language, customs, and architecture, attended a Dutch Reformed church, and were active in the fur trade and commercial purposes, and a British garrison community with an Anglican church well into the 18th century. The British occupied and administered Albany as an outpost of empire, which meant dealing with Indians diplomatically. The Dutch continued their commerce, which meant trading with the Indians. Another description of the lasting Dutch cultural influence in the Hudson Valley comes from the work entitled Mohawk Baronet by James Flexner. He writes, thrust by the navigable Hudson deep into the wilderness, that little city, Albany, seemed to have been imported entirely from urban Holland. Bijou houses, entiled in the brightest colors, turned their stepped gables to the street. Dutch gutturals resounded, and in the midst of the shaggy forest, everything was neat. Orchards were tended as carefully as drawing rooms. Let's look at how the Dutch religion came to represent this period of change and the global connection of its patrons. Take the old Dutch church in Sleepy Hollow. Margaret Hardenbrock had commissioned the original bell in 1685 from London. It sat for 10 years until Frederick Philip's second wife, Catherine, decided to start construction on the upper mills of Philip's lands and astride the Pocantico River. Constructed of glacial boulder deposits pulled from the hilly terrain, held together by plaster made of Hudson River mud and whitewashed with coral sourced by the East India Company in the Caribbean, this syncretic structure would serve to fulfill the spiritual needs of Dutch settlement retreating from an encroaching English world in Manhattan. The labor of hauling the mud, rolling the boulders, and applying the wash would have fallen to Malagasy slaves, the product of a Phillips partnership with the pirate haven of St. Marie. This small island off the northeast coast of Madagascar was a haven of smuggling, slaving, and privateering. The Confederation of Pirates were powerful enough to personally invite the manor lord Frederick Phillips to send his ships around the Cape of Good Hope to receive discounted slaves and participate in duty-free trade. This description according to historian Jean Zimmerman. The first major patroon ship was doled out to the Dutch diamond merchant Van Rensselaer in 1630. Only those in the Hudson Valley region would survive the British takeover, albeit in different legal form. The Rensselaer family would outlast the Dutch and British eras and mark the end of their rule in upstate New York almost 200 years later. The Phillips Manor is another example of the continued practice of patroonships under English rule. Dutch merchant heiress Margaret Hardenbrook combined her trade enterprise with the craftsmanship and political connections of Frederick Phillips to found a landed dynasty that would last a century until the American Revolution. The family signed the requisite loyalty oath during the 1664 takeover, and their story marks the transformation of the Dutch merchant class into political feudal clans that would serve as linchpins of British rule. The Phillips, Van Cortlands, Schuylers, Livingstons, Hardenbergs, and Rensselaers would intermarry and form the backbone of the ruling colonial class in the Hudson Valley for the next century. Many of Patroon's would ease into this position after the political reforms of the 1680s that reorganized colonial New York into counties and chartered cities. The colonial assembly and important positions in diplomacy, trade, and the judiciary were open to the Patroons. The Indian commissioners that the state heavily relied upon to facilitate communication between the Iroquois and Albany were also filled by former Dutch traders and representatives of the Patroon families. This position would grow in prestige and power, exemplified by Sir William Johnson's key role in the French and Indian War more than 75 years later. Internally, New York was impacted by political chaos back in England. As the leader of popular resistance to the Jacobite regime of King James, Jacob Leisler controlled Manhattan and the Hudson Valley as acting lieutenant governor from 1689 to 1691. He helped set aside land that would grow into the modern Westchester County city of New Rochelle. He managed to establish a pseudo-popular assembly that played on the anti-Catholic feelings of the Glorious Revolution and used direct democratic actions to maintain his authority. Iroquois diplomacy was so deft, they played both sides of Leisler's conflict here in New York. They realized the division between those elite who wanted to cling to the old Dutch cultural power base and those newer manor lords who sought to jump on the anglicizing trend of their leaders ruling from Manhattan. Anglophiles of the League partnered with the Albany Convention, headed by the Schuyler family. They resisted Leisler's efforts and that of Dutch supporters within the city walls. Affirming the covenant chain was with the anti-Leisler faction. Mohawk warriors prevented the militia members from storming the city. French raids into the Mohawk Valley forced a temporary alliance of the two European factions and the Iroquois League, but naval defeats and disease reduced the promising campaign to nothing. The Leisler faction bungled the logistics, and the newly appointed crown government of William and Mary executed the faction leaders in 1691. The League barely turned out to a renewed campaign under the fresh royal governor of New York. Instead, the raiding just increased communal tensions between Iroquois and their praying brethren along the St. Lawrence. Some historians view the episode as a grassroots Dutch revolt against English rule, but the movement didn't have the support of the Dutch Reformed Church and clashed with the Dutch descended Patroons. Thomas Gildersleeve was my 8th great-grandfather on my maternal side and bridged this transitional gap. He was born on the eastern end of Long Island in 1660, under the governor generalship of Peter Stuyvesant, and would later serve as a militia captain under Lieutenant Governor Leisler. During Queen Anne's War, Iroquois neutrality was tested with Mohawk Chief Hendrick's 1710 visit to London and the acquiescence toward resettlement of Palatine Germans along the Mohawk River. Hoping to counter Dutch influence in the Hudson Valley, Palatine settlers were envisioned as loyal to the crown and potential workers on naval store plantations along the upper Hudson and Mohawk. Failed English naval expeditions during the war and Iroquois diplomatic duplicity only created further imperial tensions between France and England. These Palatine refugees were greatly abused by the Patroon overlords and proved to be an unruly and stubbornly independent bunch. Over 30 years later, Sir William Johnson would find a large number of these Palatine families staking freeholds across the Mohawk Valley and firmly within his new land grants. The War of Austrian Succession increased the supply of slave labor within the Hudson Valley, and Johnson used those in bondage to lease out to the Palatine freeholders and ease their own troubled status by recognizing their claims under his general grant. His partnership with the Palatine refugees formed a significant part of his power base, with Mohawk support being the other source of his power. This allowed him to successfully resist the Albany Patroons and assume the position of Indian Commissioner once again at the start of the French and Indian War. The area of the Passaic and Raritan Rivers had been settled early on by the Dutch out of New Amsterdam, but the transition to English rule allowed for further migration to places like Newark or the future Newark. Dutch and then English settlers had obtained deeds to these lowland riverine areas by the early 18th century, but this circumvented royal allotment to proprietors. It was these new owners who had the legal right to distribute the land and collect rent. By 1745, tensions in the Jerseys had reached a boiling point, with evictions being enforced throughout Essex County. Debtors were taken to the jail in Newark, but settlers marched to free their compatriots. This illustrated the insular nature of the English power base at Newark, and contrasted with the separate and longer-established Dutch syncretic world of the Riverine Basin. Monies were collected to send petitions and representative missions to Parliament, and this effort was repeated within the colonies as well. Eventually settled within the courts, violent local acts of resistance would continue for several years after, as the tenants refused to continue paying the onerous quit rent. As the 18th century wore on, patroons became increasingly reliant on rent payments and put little back into their properties. Some even rented out manors to overseers who ratcheted up the rent even further. Military armed action was sanctioned against British colonists for the first time during William Prendergast's Rebellion, or what is also called the Levellers' Revolt of 1765 to 1766. Philip's manor tenants from the Upper Hudson Valley revolted and marched on local jails to free those imprisoned for debt by the patroons. In the following year, an army of 1,500 rebels marched on New York City and parleyed with the governor on the banks of the Harlem River. They agreed to turn away if British officials did not intervene in their dispute with the patroons. The manor lords influenced British troops to take action, leading to the attempted arrest of Prendergast near Poughkeepsie, New York, by 300 British troops. Although the rebels fought fiercely from fortified hilltop stone farmhouses, the British discipline eventually overcame their provincial spirit. Prendergast was condemned to death, but was saved by a royal pardon obtained by his wife. These rebellious tenants became the backbone of American forces in New York, led by a portion of the patroons. The other half of Dutch New York leadership was soon to be driven into exile. The period after the English takeover from the Dutch is one of the imposition of a feudal-like system of the great landed manorial estates of the Hudson Valley. The original Dutch Van Rensselaer patroonship spread out into branches of the Livingstons, Phillips, and Van Cortlands. These odd hybrids of Dutch, Scottish, and English rent lords would rule the valley until the American Revolution. Their tenants would support the patriot cause and force most into exile. The Schuyler and main branch of the Van Rensselaer families remained loyal to the American cause, though. Stephen Van Rensselaer IV was the last patroon, and his manor patent was terminated by New York State voters in 1846, when he insisted on collecting $11 million in rent debt owed by tenants. His personal wealth at the time of his patent termination was somewhere between $30 to $40 million. Thanks for listening to New York, Quebec, and the water route to the center of the world. Please remember to leave a review and follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, and my new YouTube channel, NYQC 1754 Podcast.